Brother David.
Hi, Ken. Good to hear your voice.
Oh, it's been too long. It's wonderful hearing you now. And I'm really, really looking forward to the conversation because basically we're here to discuss your book, Deeper Than Words, Living the Apostles' Creed. And what it really is an interpretation of the Apostles' Creed, well, from your perspective, and your perspective being one that I particularly value and I think has a great deal of truth and goodness and reality to it. And so by seeing how you have interpreted or reinterpreted the creed, you can really get much, much more to the very heart of Christianity. And Christianity as a truly Catholic, that is to say, universal faith. And I think it's just a terrific statement. I think it's an important theological statement. And very much looking forward to going through it with you.
Well, I'm very grateful for this opportunity. And that you find it helpful means an awful lot to me, because I think very highly of your approach and of your theology. And I've told you that before, so it makes me very happy to be able to do that.
Excellent. Well, let's just go through it. Let me first read your explanation of what you've done. Taking its statements, the Creed's statements, one by one, I've applied a three-pronged tool to each of them, asking three decisive questions. By asking, what does this really mean? I try to pry open the hard shell of preconceived notions that tends to form around set expressions we hear used too often. Once this shell is cracked and you know what you mean, I ask, how do you know? How do you personally know that this statement is true? This question no longer allows us to juggle with concepts, but forces us to link them with experience, yours, the reader's, since experience is the basis for genuine knowing. Finally, I ask, why is this so important? Important enough to be part of as succinct a document as the Creed. Important, therefore, to the one who recites the Creed. My what, how, why give this book its formula. Deep inner peace, a sense of belonging, and a firm anchorage in the eternal now of the present moment. These are among the fruits that struggling humans throughout the centuries have reaped from faith expressed in the Creed. So, with that beautiful explanation, the book just begins, and it has just one or two words per chapter. It just takes a small phrase at a time and then applies those three questions to it. And so I'm just going to read a few of the sections that you have in explanation. The first words to the Creed are, I believe, to which you say, only an I brave enough for the radical confidence of unconditional trust can be our true self. Our little ego, which we often mean when we say I, is incapable of the courageous trust of faith. The I that says, I believe, is our true self, the one authentic self that all humans have in common. And as soon as we embark on the journey of self-exploration, we discover the distinction between the self we observe and a bigger self that does the observing. The more we learn to live in the now, the more we will discover the self. As simple a practice as being alert to the opportunity each moment offers us, opportunity to breathe, to enjoy, to learn, will make us more and more at home in that self, which is one with all. And so that is the self that you are saying right at the beginning. That's the self that is expressing belief in this creed. It's only this higher, truer self that can have faith in this creed.
Yes, that seems so important to me, to anchor it in that experience of that greater self.
Right.
Because formally, or in all the commentaries on the Apostles' Creed that I have come across, and there are many excellent ones from all centuries and also from our time, some very good ones, and they really ask, what does it mean, and give an answer of what does the church mean by it, or what has tradition meant by it. It comes from the outside.
Right.
And by adding this second question, how do you know?
Right.
And that means how do you personally know? You
right.
anchor it to that deeper self that alone can make that inner act of believing, of trusting, of this unconditional trust in life, ultimately.
Right.
And so it's a completely new approach in that respect.
Yes. And that's one of the things I love about it right off the bat is it's saying at the very, very beginning of the creed that what you are about to read is the expression not of an ordinary, typical, normal self, but of our authentic self, our true self, our bigger self, the pure witness, the pure self that is common to all humanity. And that true self is capable of having faith in the following items. And so you get anchored in that true self, and then the following becomes an expression of what that true self has faith in, but not what the small self.
Right. And when you say the following items, it is really, when you come to the true self, it is only always one reality, actuality, more than reality. It's not a thing, but it's an actuality that you can have faith in, and that is what those who use the word God correctly call God. You don't have to call it God. You can call it life. You call it,
right.
call it the ultimate, whatever you call it.
Right.
But this is the only item that the creed deals with. And then that was another one of my efforts in this book, to show that every one of those articles of faith are simply new ways of saying, I believe in God, or
right.
I believe
right.
in the ultimate, or simply, I believe, because believing is kind of open-ended and points in a direction
right.
More than a God, certainly more than a God out there. It's a direction towards God, and ultimately, when the circle closes in the end, my hope is that the reader will have caught on that that bigger self within ourselves that can say, I believe, is already the divine self, and so we are totally immersed in the divine.
Right, right. So it's I believe or even I experience.
I experience, yes. Believing is a particular kind of experiencing, and namely the experience of trust. And this trust is difficult. It takes courage.
Right.
Trust in life, we experience that in crisis situations. It takes courage. And that courageous trust is really what the word faith means. But the word faith is so misleading because people immediately jump to thinking that it means believing something.
Right.
This or that. I believe it's going to rain, or I believe
right.
in ghosts or something
right.
like that. Well, actually, I believe in this sense means simply I ultimately and unconditionally trust and am prepared to take the consequences and act accordingly.
Right. And this is something that comes to the authentic self. You continue, try to feel your way inside toward the core of yourself, where you are the watcher who is not your thoughts, but can watch them. This going inward unveils yourself to yourself, your Christ self. The more we identify with this reality, the more we become uniquely ourselves and, at the same time, one with all others. Only this self, capital S, can, quote, believe in the full sense. Only our true self can trust unconditionally.
Yeah.
If we understand the first two words of the creed correctly, we know what believing means and which I is speaking here. This turns out to show that the creed is not what most people think it is. Usually it is taken to be a proclamation of beliefs by which Christians distinguish themselves from all others. Rightly understood, however, it is the expression of a faith shared by all who find and acknowledge their true self. And there is no other faith. What people call different faiths are merely different belief systems, different expressions of the one universal attitude of existential faith. Far from affirming differences between us and the others, the creed takes the sting out of those distinctions. It proclaims, in the language and imagery of the Christian tradition, a faith that is common to all human beings. Its very first word stands for that self to which all spiritual traditions point the way. And I think that's just extremely important.
Well, if you have, by reading the book, if you have seen that this is verified, so to say, in my approach, that this is really underlying my approach, then I have great hopes that other people will see it too. That was my great concern. I have a question for you. For instance, when I speak of this self in the Christian context of the creed, if I speak of this true self once in a while as the Christ self,
yes,
it sounds a bit too Christian, but on the other hand, we are dealing with a Christian text.
Yes.
My question is Christ self by now a term that people just generally can understand what it means? It means the divine self or something like that.
Right. Yes, I think because you give a lot of synonyms, because you explain what you mean by it, then people understand you're talking about the divine self, the true self, the authentic self. And then since you are explaining it from a Christian vantage point, then the Christ self just points out how that true self can be talked about in the Christian tradition. But it doesn't say, you know, Christ is the only version of that self. So I think it's fine.
Yeah, we are all versions of that self, or rather, we are all expressions of that one self, because there is only one self, which
right.
we all share, and that is another great,
right.
very important insight that we all have to push through to.
Right. I believe in God, the next phrase. This initial statement contains, as in a seed, the whole of the creed. It means that I dedicate myself in complete trust to a power greater than myself. The original connotation of believing was not so different from giving one's heart. The word has the same linguistic root as love. In this initial proclamation of the creed, the word God is used merely as a pointer. It indicates a direction, the direction of the human heart's ultimate trust. And at this point in the creed, the term God refers merely to the goal of an inveterate longing of the human heart for meaning.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that seems very important to me, that we don't get the idea that we know already something vaguely about God out there, and
right.
then we say, and we believe in that God, that would only believing that this God exists or something of that sort.
Right.
While believing comes first, this trust in life, this basic trust.
Right.
And it's just as you read aloud, it's a direction in which this trust goes. It's not yet filled in by anything.
Right. And you address that further down, but many people have become allergic, as it were, to the word God. In an attempt to point at the experiential reality without pushing the wrong linguistic button, I often use synonyms, ultimate reality, ground of being, source of life, and the like. Yet, when we want to understand the creed, our task is not to replace the word God with a different one, but rather to deepen our understanding of its meaning. Then you speak, for example, of peak experiences. The individuals having peak experiences reported experiences in which they felt a sense of limitless belonging. and experience the goodness and beauty of all that exists, very much like the great mystics of the different spiritual traditions. So we're pointing that this is anchored in those experiential realities you're talking about, and it's not just a, you know, quote, belief, as beliefs normally taken.
That's right. I take the reader to be a mystic, and that is also different from the normal approach to the creed. But as Maslow pointed out, he didn't say it with so many words, but by his findings, by his purely psychological findings of how widespread the peak experience is and how undistinguishable it is from the mystic experience, he could say the mystic is not a special kind of human being, but every human being is a special kind of mystic.
Yeah.
And that is how I approach the reader.
Right. And so the creed becomes a statement of a universal faith under those circumstances. You continue, ask yourself, what gives my life meaning? Meaning springs from belonging. Our deepest belonging is our belonging to God. But wait, do not assume that we start out by knowing what we mean by God. The particular form in which we express our faith in God is not of ultimate importance. It can change. What does matter most is this: to discover the ocean depth in which we have sunk our anchor of meaning, to recognize that is what God means for us, and to let this meaning flow into our daily living. The formula, I believe in God, points from the very start toward a Trinitarian understanding. God stands for the unfathomable mystery of which I come and to which I am related. The I stands for the human self, capital S, in whom the universe becomes explicitly conscious of God and of itself. And to believe stands for the third dimension of that divine life which unites the two poles of God and I in the dynamic creative process of living and loving. Step by step, the creed will reveal what this first all-important sentence anticipates. And so that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Yes, yes, and the creed is, of course, a Trinitarian formula. And these three dimensions are there from the very beginning and are then only unfolded, but they are dimensions of that one ultimate mystery in which we can put our ultimate trust.
Right.
And the whole creed unfolds that. And I have all along for many years now admired the way in which your understanding is not monistic and not dualistic,
right,
but Trinitarian. And,
right,
and I think we have talked about that before.
Right.
But that is so important because people discover today that dualism doesn't lead you anywhere.
Right.
It just is not applicable. But then the danger is so great that they slide immediately into a sort of monism.
Right.
And you have so skillfully avoided that by in various ways, and I try to do it in my own way.
Right.
And the creed is, of course, makes that very easy because the creed is a statement of faith in the triune God.
Right.
It was the statement of those who were to be baptized in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit.
Right.
So that was the original concern.
Right. What you start to learn, even if you believe in an ultimate non-dual reality, which in a certain sense I think both you and I do, you still come up with the tricky question about what's the relation between the one and the many. Sooner or later, you have to introduce boundaries because this world has boundaries in it. So sooner or later, you have to face how out of the Godhead comes the distinctions. And so the Trinitarian distinction is, in many ways of looking at it, and you just gave one right here, another way to look at it is it's first person, second person, and third person view of spirit. The Father is a second person thou, Christ is Christ's self, is first person I, and Holy Spirit as objective dynamic energy of the whole entire universe is third person. That's just one of many ways you can look at it, but it at least starts to take into account the fact that even if you have, believe in a non-dual Godhead, there still has to occur manifestation. And so you might as well deal with, you know, the relationship and manifestation right at the start. That's what Trinitarian doctrine does. It's a careful look at the manifest world, how the manifest world comes to be and is related to each other.
Another tradition is, of course, the Hindu tradition that has expressed that very beautifully in the unmanifest divinity or ultimate Brahman, in the manifest Atman, and in the statement Atman is Brahman and Brahman is Atman, the manifest is the unmanifest and the unmanifest is the manifest, and in this is already the understanding, which is the dynamic connection between the two. And it means much more than intellectual understanding. It means a commitment, means action, means all the dynamism that is in your scheme connected with the third person.
Right. Right, exactly. And even Hinduism does have Brahman and Atman, but on the unmanifest side, the Nirguna Brahman side, which is pure emptiness, pure formlessness. And then there's the manifest side of Saguna Brahman, Brahman with characteristics. And those are three major characteristics. There's the Atman or I, there's Ishvara or personal God, and there's Prakriti or the dynamic energy of the whole manifest universe, very like the Holy Spirit. And all those three are, of course, one with Nirguna Brahman. So it gets to the same point. It's just saying, fine, let's look at, though, this manifestation, and let's look at this Trinity, because that is an important part of you know, manifest world. So it's an important
concept. If people who are looking to us talking about this think that this is very abstruse and sort of detached from everyday reality, in my experience, it is most intimately linked with your stance in the world, with your trust in other people, with your respect for the dignity of other people, with all the practical things that are so important today.
Right.
Did you get a feeling for that in reading the book? That would be important to me.
Yes, and we start to increase that depth right here in the section I'll read, in terms of connecting the Christian God with, you know, the entire world. Christian tradition calls the manifestation of God in all that exists the cosmic Christ. The whole universe is God's body. One reason why I am fond of seeing the universe as God's body is that this metaphor could immensely increase our reverence for Mother Earth and thus give our male God image a healthy jolt. Can you imagine, you know, what it might do to our imagination if we could get ourselves to recognize the injuries we have inflicted on our environment as wounds in God's body? That's a jolt.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful way to put that. So what we're dealing with all of these are, you know, how do you connect the absolute and the relative? And that's, you know, how do you connect the one and the many? And so sooner or later we have to deal with it. Sooner or later we have to deal with the, you know, the existence of boundaries. And the Trinity just says, yes, there are boundaries and they're all divine. So it's a particularly beautiful way of coming to terms with that.
Yeah. I have often wondered how it was possible in the first three or four centuries of the Christian tradition, when this notion of the Trinity, as it is now standard theologically accepted, when this was hammered out, it took a very long time to hammer this out in its present form. And there was so much politics involved. This bishop from this city wanted to have his say and Trump over the other one and so on. That one wonders, and one was, of course, excommunicating the other. So you were wondering, how could they ever arrive at some agreement? How could they ever arrive at agreement? And the only answer that I can find is that it was anchored in a deep human understanding. You could bring arguments even from the New Testament, from the Greek Bible. You can bring arguments for every point that they are not equal and that they are, that the Son is subject to the Father and the Holy Spirit is rather vague. Anyway, you could prove anything from the Bible with regard to the Trinity, but they arrived at this agreement of the equality and the unity and all that is now standard theology because of a much more deeper, long pre-Christian human experience that we experience that mystery, beyond mystery, from which we come and to which we go, which we call Father, and that reality, that manifestation of that mystery in everything there is, ourselves included.
Right.
And that's what we call the Son in Christian tradition. And then we experience the dynamism that connects the two. And that's what we call the Holy Spirit. And you have, again, your first, second, and third person.
I agree entirely. And I think it is anchored in a deep human experience. And that's why I think that we can find extremely similar notions arising at just about the same time period, the 2nd, 3rd century Common Era. We can find similar terms arising in, for example, the Buddhist notion of the three bodies of Buddha, the Trikaya.
Is it that late? I didn't realize it was that late. I have been very amazed and enthusiastic about those three kayas, and you have spoken about it. I'd like to hear more from you about it, but I didn't realize it was that late.
It starts to appear for certain in the Lankavatara Sutra, and of course, as with all Eastern documents, it's kind of hard to date.
Yeah.
But the last date I saw, anyway, was around 200 A.D. It could have been earlier, but it was arising with the whole arising of Mahayana, and that means Nagarjuna, and Nagarjuna is around 200 A.D. But it could have been earlier, but its point was they were facing the tricky issue, which is if Gautama Buddha is truth, then what happens to truth when Gautama Buddha dies?
And they
came up with, well, wait a minute, Gautama Buddha was actually one of three bodies of Buddha. He was simply the historical, fleshy, manifest Nirmanakaya, the name body.
Yeah.
He was the body that showed up in time and showed up in history. And that, of course, would be Jesus Christ. And then the truth he realized was vast mystery, vast emptiness, vast unborn, namely the Dharma Kaya.
Yeah.
And that stays forever. That doesn't come or go with Buddha's birth or death. It's just that this particular historical Gautama Buddha realized the truth of the Dharma Kaya and was therefore released from all pain and suffering. And the connection of the two, the dynamic transformative body that connects the Nirmanakaya to the Dharmakaya, is the Sambhogakaya, the Holy Spirit. So we have a three-body notion in the East that's very, very similar to these. And so I agree with you. It's the only reason that they could come up with something like this is that it is a human experience.
And that gives us, of course, a very different approach to the different religious traditions in general. On the one hand, we take them more lightly than we might be inclined to do. On the other hand, we see their great importance. If we realize that each of them is a different expression of that basic human faith.
Right.
The human faith is what connects us, and the different expressions are there because that faith crystallized in this or that tradition at a certain point in history,
right,
and in a certain culture, also mediated by very different people. If you think, for instance, of Jesus being a very young man and a kind of mystic revolutionary,
yeah,
non-violent revolutionary and mystic who died in his very early 30s,
right.
Buddha living a very long life and coming from a noble family,
right.
Completely
right.
Different situation. Also,
right.
Of course, the India of Buddha's time is very different from the Holy Land in the time of Jesus and all that.
Right.
So, and so with Muhammad, and so with the less personally known, or historically known founders of other traditions.
Right.